Five.
Right, okay,
but
so
we're on page 359, I think.
Right, 359. We're continuing our class on the introduction to the Beit HaMikdash of our long series that we're going to have on the Beit HaMikdash, or Beis HaMikdash, depending on how you pronounce words like that. Okay, so we didn't get very far on our first page, I don't think.
No, we didn't. I wrote here, keep going.
All right, good. Where did you write that, on 361?
357.
357, okay.
We're on 359.
Okay, 359.
You did the Beit HaMikdash last week?
Maybe we did.
Did I miss last week?
No, you were here.
Yeah, I think so.
We
yeah.
just started. Well, we just barely got into it.
That you weren't here last week?
Yeah.
You were here last week. Yeah.
I don't remember
it either. Oh, my goodness.
Miriam was here.
Now, here's two left. Do you don't have these two pages?
No. Marlon was here.
I think everybody was here.
I thought we were here. We had a big crowd.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, but I remember doing the Beit HaMikdash.
Yeah, she's got the page. No, I'm giving you that. That's the last page. These are those two. So I'll just look on for the first place. We got up to just about here. Why build a mikdash? I think we talked about that. Why build a mikdash, mm-hmm. right? We got to that. Mm-hmm. And now intrinsic holiness versus invested holiness we're up to, right? And no, why build a mikdash? We didn't because you don't have any notes for that.
Right. We got to how and why one serves God. That's how far we got.
Achieve a relationship to emulate.
Right.
God,
right.
God
right.
is
okay.
giver, we are the receiver.
Right. So why?
Oh, that I remember.
Right. Okay.
I didn't put that in
the It's interesting. I read a long article today, yesterday from Rabbi Benjamin Bleich, I think, on the Star of David's in the new proposed Park 51 Cordoba Mosque. I don't know if you've seen the picture of it, but it's basically the whole facade of is Stars of David.
For that mosque going up by
yes.
Ground Zero?
The uh-huh. facade is Stars of David?
Uh-huh.
And how do they justify that?
So some people say, like Naomi Regan says, it looks like Stars of David and crosses falling down, which it does sort of. So is it a picture of a crumbling of the towers or of Jewish and Christian symbols tumbling to make way for the mosque? That's one theory on it. Or, according to the mosque, and if you look inside, also, it has all kinds of imagery of pentagons and the escalator going down that looks kind of like a boot right onto the pentagon, like a pentagon ship. Oh, yeah, it's fascinating to see inside. Anyway. Pardon?
No,
this is just
the
design. But the star, but he writes a lot about the symbolism of the Star of David, because the builders of the mosque said, yes, this is a symbol, not just a Jewish symbol, but a universal symbol of spirituality. And so Rabbi Bleich writes a whole article on the symbol of spirituality that it is, and it seems that it comes first, anybody who's read the Da Vinci Code, you know, from the two stars, one going up towards the heavens and one coming down towards the earth, and the melding of the two. And it's a particularly Jewish symbol that symbolizes also the menorah because of the six and the seven. So there's 6 points within seventh inner dimension, which is the symbol of the Jews, 6 days of the week and a seventh inner dimension, Shabbos, or the concept that the seventh inner dimension holds together all the 6 points of externality. And that's symbolized also in the menorah that has the central branch and then the six other flames that point towards the center. So that's still 6 external points pointing towards one inner dimension of internal order. So, so he says, if that's the symbol of the Jews, that the spiritual and the physical are integrated and held together by a central core point, and that's what we Jews represent in the world and are teaching to the world, then let others embrace it and bring it to the world. That's our job, is to teach the nations about this concept and let others embrace it. Good morning, Ty.
Good morning.
So anyway, I thought that was interesting just to see.
Yeah. The thing is, they don't have any money yet.
Well, the one that bought the property, he said the reason he came up with the idea is that he used to go to the JCC and the idea of having a community center and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he was saying.
Yeah, but which JCC has a shul in it? JCCs are all about sports.
Already, though, according to 60 Minutes, they've already been praying in the main floor of the building.
But what I'm saying is if he thought about it because of JCCs, then he shouldn't have thought spiritual. Because
right.
JCCs are not.
Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm saying
in New York, they
what
frequently
what
have yeah? the Y and the 92nd Street Y. And
also doesn't have a prayer facility in it. I lived there for 2 years. Nope. Sports, entertainment, theater, library, but not Jewish. I mean, it's Jews who live there, but I don't think you have to be a Jew to live there.
No, I'm sure
you have to be young to live there. I think it's 18 to 26 can live there.
To live where?
92nd Street Y. The YMHA, known as the Y 92nd Street Y. So they have a dorm. So I went to Hunter College, so that's a commuter college. So if you're in Manhattan but you don't have a place to live, you're going to Juilliard or whatever, that's a place for Jewish students to live. Okay. Where are we? You think we're in the middle? Okay.
I think
we're up to
that,
why build a Mikdash.
First paragraph, and that's what I think.
I think we're among the people who observe the mitzvot.
Right. Oh, okay. So this was about this is about serving God. So it seems that there's two categories that he's discussing. There's so much philosophy in this. That's why I don't want to just buzz through this and say there's a mitzvah to build the temple. Gobs of philosophy in here. It's really a fascinating, lengthy explanation of a mitzvah. Rav Gavriel Goldfeder told me when I said that we're studying Sefer Chinuch, he said, wow, that's such a maverick book. I'm like, maverick? Like, he's a maverick author. He says, yeah, to offer explanations for the mitzvot and philosophy. It's not something that's usually done. And he has it. So we Jews today are so used to being explained,
doesn't
the whys.
Seem maverick,
right? It doesn't seem like mavericky at all.
2-year-old's favorite word? Why?
Why? Right. So this says it, but apparently it was one of the first and is the best that, you know, says this kind of thing. And we just take it so for granted, but you should know that in general, it hasn't been explained. You do it because God said to do it, and that's why you do it. And to understand the whys isn't necessarily a prerequisite at all. It's not a prerequisite for sure. We said na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will hear. So that we will hear is really hear how to do it. First we promise we're going to do it, now tell us what we're supposed to do. It's not we promise we're going to do it, now explain to us why we're doing it.
But you know, you say that contemporary people, we want to know why. This was written when again?
Right. We want to know why before we do. This was written in the 1500s, right, for Bar Mitzvoy, or even before.
Then?
Right.
He must have been
he's answering
this to give this to his son.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he was answering his own questions.
So there's two different ways to observe it. He's explaining here among those who do observe. He's not even thinking about it because at that time there weren't very many Jews who didn't observe. So there are those who do it because it's good for them, meaning they know they're going to get Olam Haba. So they want to do it because they understand this is the best system for them to be involved in, and so they're going to be involved in it because it's good for them, they're going to get eternal life, and that's what they want. Yet, at the end of that paragraph, they did not attain the ultimate level of the good, the divine intention. Really, the higher level is to do it in a way without reward, but it's really because you want to be in a relationship, which means you get a better reward. It's not for the sake of reward, it's for the sake of relationship. So it's sort of like, in a way, today, what's better, sucking up to your teacher or actually creating a relationship? You know, I mean, I have a high school son who is busy creating a relationship with a next year teacher to make sure he's in good. Yeah. So the question is, do you want to create a relationship or do you just want to create the hollow shell of making yourself look good in front of them? Making yourself look good in front of them does probably get you a better grade. But you probably get better guidance and you get the grade and the guidance and a better education if you actually create a real relationship. Not just for the sake of the grade, no problem. Not just for the sake of the grade, but for the sake of the relationship. And then you get the grade and the relationship and the guidance that comes with it. Right? But it has to be not for the grade. It has to be because you really want to be in that relationship. So that's what it's saying, is there's the two different ways to observe here. One is for the good that you could get out of it, and the other is to be in a relationship with God, really. So that's what it says, until they set, in the middle of that second paragraph there, until they set their entire intent of their physical ability on the purpose of completing the desire of the eternal Lord out of their great yearning for him. So this is not about yearning for me, this is about yearning for God. Right? That's the second level and the higher level. This great level is the one that the three patriarchs, to which the three patriarchs ascended, and many of their descendants after them, and this is the highest level to which a man can possibly ascend. Okay, now that we know that, he says, right, so that's why we do the mitzvahs, but with that in mind, why build a temple, he's saying. Now that we understand this, we could totally understand that God for sure doesn't need a house. No question about it. No need for a Parthenon. No need for a beautiful place that God can live in. It's not about us building a house for God. It's about us engaging our lives in the building of something that transforms us so that God can live in us. So we've spoken about that before, right? Va'asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tochem. Make for me a mikdash and I will live in you. It's about how do we use our actions to create inside us a space that God can live in. So certainly building that place on earth accomplishes that. But what is that place on earth? Why build a place on earth? Why not just the other mitzvahs? Why do we need this one? What's the point of that? So it turns out that we can aspire to greatness and holiness, and yet we live in this world. This world's a tricky place to achieve that in. There's so much distraction. Forget all the electronic devices that we have today, which is a whole another level of distraction that was unimaginable to any previous generation, even to us as children. I don't care how young you are, you're probably the youngest in this room. Even to you as a child, would not have been imaginable what's going on today, just beyond anybody's capability to imagine. But forgetting all of that, just go back 100 years. Still, life was full of distractions. Just putting food on the table and a roof over your head and keeping your clothes on and clean and, you know, and some kind of education, forget meaning in life, just to function was not easy. So with all that distraction and all the physicality that's in this world, and then let's say you did get on top of it, so now you have some extra time and extra money that could go towards good or bad. Now you have to choose good or bad. You know, what do you want to do? I read an article yesterday, I think, in the Wall Street Journal that talked about how the state has accomplished something that no bookie ever had the temerity to advance, which is to try to tell you that gambling is good. Gambling is a moral duty because you're helping support the school system and whatever, that it's important to gamble. Now, something that's right. Something that's been a vice all these, like, no bookie would ever have the temerity. They would get you to gamble, but never the temerity to say that it's a moral responsibility to do it. And the state is doing that. So, right. So with extra time and money, you can choose what you want to do with that. How do you want to spend it? So with all that going on, we have to understand that it's very tricky to be holy in this world, right? Which is why a fifth of our days, as we've mentioned before, are holy days. So at least we have time in this world that's holy. So between Sabbaths and holidays, one fifth of our calendar is made up of holy days. That's to try to balance this out and out, but that's only a fifth. That means that four fifths is not holy days and we are devoted to the rest of our physical pursuits. So it still is very tricky. We're out of balance. So we need a holy city and a super holy place also that we can come to for a pendulum swing every once in a while, just to come and immerse ourselves.
So is it harder for us now to be holy because we don't have that space?
Yes, absolutely. And we can't even understand what that is. That's one of the things we talk about in Tisha B'Av, is that
we
can't even cry.
So are we jealous if people go to Mecca, or not jealous? Or
No, because...
Wow, that's not.
So Mecca has, the reason why Mecca is there as a pilgrimage place is only because of the temple in Jerusalem.
They learned from us.
Yeah, that there should be a pilgrimage, that there should be fasting, that there should be physical engagement in something. They're trying to figure it out. But if you start to look at it clearly, it's so different than everything that we have, and that's why it's important to learn the philosophy of what our stuff is, like when we look at sacrifices in just a minute. It's a completely different thing. You know, so like Donnie, who's bread baking, and he watched on History Channel like some history of bread on his computer, because we don't have a TV, but whatever. Computers bring everything into the house.
Everything.
We don't need a TV.
You can have a TV.
We're
don't need
fully
a TV
trafe without the TV. So so he's watching all that bread baking. So one of the sections, it's all these different types of bread. So one was on the Jewish woven, I don't know, I said woven instead of braided, but the Jewish woven Sabbath bread, challah. And challah takes its name from the piece of dough that used to be given in ancient days to the Kohens, but now is thrown into the fire as a sacrifice. Mm. And I'm thinking, what?
It's thrown into the fire as a sacrifice.
That's what he said. I'm thinking, that's very skewed. That's a complete misunderstanding of what it is. It's not a sacrifice. You're not burning a sacrifice. You're not breaking off a piece of your bread to sacrifice it to God. right? You're burning it because it has kedusha and it can't be consumed by people today in this state. So it is just to keep us in practice. We do need to separate that piece. It's a question if we should make a bracha or not on it inside, outside of Eretz Israel, outside of the land of Israel. It's not 100% clear that it's a mitzvah that falls on us. And yet we do it to keep ourselves in practice. It does have sanctity, that little piece. It can't be consumed. Maybe if we know a Kohen, we could probably bake it and give it to their dog, because Kohen's animals can eat things that have Kedusha. Trumot and Masrot, as we've mentioned before.
Kohen's have dogs?
Okay, forget that they have dogs, if they do or not. Today in Israel, where they have to separate Trumot and Masrot from the crops in Israel, what do you do with all that food? You're not going to waste it. A Kohen can't eat it. So the biblical zoo is owned by Kohanim, so that all the animals can eat that food. So I'm just making a, for instance, if we had a neighbor who's a Kohen that had a dog, I don't know, could we feed our challah to that dog? Possibly. But the Kohen can't eat it because he's not tahor. Right? So we don't give challah to Kohanim today. But we certainly aren't we're not making a sacrifice
It's not like you had this much bread and now we only want you to have that much bread.
Right. It's not that at all. So anyway. Pardon? Okay, so once you knead dough of a certain quantity of flour, so from about 14, 15 cups and above, you have to separate out a small piece to give to a Kohen.
So it's only if you're making
Right. That's called the challah. And so challah, Sabbath challah, is called that, named after that piece that you separate out. But that piece that you separate out is technically the challah.
So a technical question. So if you make, because I don't make 14 cups, but I make 9 cups. So if I made 2 batches?
Yes, then you have to separate. That's correct. If you make 1 batch with 9, you still take it without a bracha.
Okay.
After 8 cups, you take without a bracha. 7 cups and below, no taking.
No taking.
But 8 cups and above, you take without a bracha. And
you could say a bracha?
No bracha until 14 cups.
So when I make 2 batches.
But that's really so like 15 cups. Don't make 14 cups, because that's really on the question mark line. Make 15 cups, and then you for sure need it.
Yeah, but I make 2 separate batches. So
that's fine. You put it together on the counter. Okay. You don't have to. As long as it's on one counter together, then it's chayav and challah. So even if you make 1 batch of yeast dough for cake, you're making babka, and you're making challah, so you have 2 different doughs, but they're both doughs that were kneaded, and they're on the counter at the same time, you take challah from them.
Cups of flour you're talking about?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How many cups did you say you think is in a 5-pound bag?
It's 4 cups to the pound, so a 5-pound bag is 20 cups.
I think it depends on 4 cups of flour, because I found that when I made challah last time, I had a 5-pound bag,
uh-huh.
And I make 2 8 cups,
uh-huh.
And I had very little. I maybe had 2 cups left.
Uh-huh. I'm sure it depends on how well it's sifted and all that stuff.
That's bread flour.
Yeah.
It's a
yeah, and it depends on how dry a day and moist a day and blah blah blah. But in general,
if you dump a 5-pound bag of flour into your challah recipe, you're pretty well covered.
Yes, you are covered. You definitely need to take challah if you're using 5 pounds. Definitely, yeah. Yeah, no question about it. If you forget and it's all baked and you're thinking, oh, I didn't take challah, you can take it from the baked bread. So you can cut a roll in half, or you can just cut off the end of a loaf or something like that. And take challah that way.
I forgot to take it one day before. I braid it the next day. I make it into loaves. I make a batch. That's usually when I take challah.
Mm-hmm.
Stick it in the refrigerator overnight and then make it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd forgotten. And I'd frozen my loaves. And Rabbi Stern said, take all the loaves and put them on the counter and put them in the towel.
Right. And then take challah. Right. Right.
And then what do you do with that?
What do you do with that? So you can burn it. You can't eat it. And you can't give it to anybody to eat today. In these times without a temple. So you either burn it or you double wrap it and throw it away so that it won't be in contact with the garbage.
Do you burn yours?
I double wrap it and throw it away. I really? Hate the smell of burnt challah.
Burn it and then throw it away.
Oy vey. You're very frum. That totally doesn't matter if you ate your Erev Tov Shalom or not. You're absolutely going to heaven. So. No, you do not have to burn it. Some people think that, but you don't have to burn it. And I personally dislike the smell. And some people hold that you can't cook anything else in the oven while it's burning.
Yeah, so I stick it in a little toaster oven. But it's still a pain because it takes hours.
A long time, right. Or you put it right on the flame on your stove and it stinks. I don't like to burn it just because it doesn't smell good.
Double wrap it and throw it away.
Yeah, so I just wrap it, double wrap it and throw it away. Put it in 2 Ziplocs. Or first I wrap it in the in the plastic wrap that was on top of the challah, and then I put that in a Ziploc and throw it away. So, and when I throw it away, I say, you know, may I be zocha sometime to give this to a kohen, because the kohen used to come to your house to take it. So I think about it. I'm sad when I throw it away. I'd rather not have to put it in the garbage. I'd rather put it in the kohen's hands that came to my house and can teach me some Torah while he's there. That was the idea, so that they came in to your home. And because
they came into your home, you didn't take it to them.
No, they came into your home, which is important because that way they see your home. You know, that way they can say, oh, your mezuzah is pointing the wrong way. Or you can say, how do I kosher this pot? I'm not quite sure. Or I wasn't sure about this hechsher. Could you show me? Could you teach me? If you have a private question, you have a kohen right there to teach you. So they came to you for that. Yeah, that was the system. They come for their sustenance. But the whole point, Mara, of this whole challah thing is the reason that you're baking bread in the first place is to sustain you physically. But the first aspect of sustenance should be for the sake of learning Torah, for the sake of doing mitzvahs. So you take the first piece of the dough to give to the kohen, the one who teaches us Torah, and we sustain Torah that way. So then the whole batch follows its head, basically. So the challah is considered the head of the dough. So everything follows the head. So once you elevate the first aspect for spiritual sustenance, for teaching and for Torah learning, then the rest should go into us. It should just help us set our minds that this bread, which does sustain us, is there to sustain us for a reason, for service, and not just for yumminess. So.
Why would you don't make it somebody else?
I don't know, but I'm pretty sure you're not allowed to do that. I mean, I know there are definitely people who say you can't. There are people who say you can't, and it makes anything else treif.
Well, I know one of the rabbis in town basically say to burn it.
Right.
On a burner on your stove.
Right.
Yeah, it does create a...
Makes your house stink. half the point of making your own challah instead of buying it is that your house should smell yummy. You know, so their kids should walk in and say... So you don't want to ruin that with right. So the idea then of the Beit HaMikdash is to establish a site, a place where we can go to, a physical place where we physical beings can go to recenter ourselves spiritually, to get back into a state of holiness, to reconnect, and to have behaviors that we can engage in that bring us back to holiness.
It would definitely be a reminder.
More than a reminder.
More than a reminder. I mean, just you'd be aware of it all the time.
It would be totally different than today. I mean, we're so distracted. This helps with the distraction, but still we're distracted, even with the Beit HaMikdash. And you see, we sinned all over the place even with it. It would definitely make it different. So now the question is, now that this place is built, where is it built and why is it built? So it's interesting. It is considered, Jerusalem is sometimes called the eye of the universe. The place of the Beit HaMikdash, so that's the center, right? The place of the Beit HaMikdash, it's considered the center of the world. That's right. So the note says, the tradition that the temple site marks the center or starting point of the formation of the earth's surface can be found most explicitly in the Zohar. And I guess also Talmud Bavli Yoma 54b. But we definitely have the concept that it's the center of the world, whatever that means. Some people say the belly button. But if you think, what is a belly button? Right? So that's the place that our umbilical cord was connected directly
point.
To our parent, to our sustaining parent, the one who gave us sustenance through that point. So in that sense, the temple is located at the belly button of the world, because it's through that spot that spiritual sustenance flows into the world and sustains the world. So we don't have that right now. We're cut off from that. So we are all choking in a world of spiritual malnourishment. We try to get our bits and pieces here and there, but it's not the same as when the temple was here sustaining the world spiritually. We lived on a different level altogether. And you could live on a different world of negativity too. You know, just like an apikoros has to know. I mean, there's a famous story in the Gemara of somebody, you know, who wants to be an apikoros, and he finds, maybe it's a Hasidic story. He goes into the Beis Medrash, and you know, somebody says, you know, he's looking for the famous apikoros, whatever his name is. Epicurus is a denier,
right.
a knowledgeable denier of God's Torah and law. So so he goes to town and he says, you know, where is the famous Epicurus? Joe. Whatever his name is, Joe, the Epicurus. He says, oh, he's in the Beis Medrash learning. He's like, what? So he goes to the Beis Medrash and he says, I want to be like you. I want to be the, you know, as bad an Epicurus as I can be. He says, well, an Amaretz can't be an Epicurus. An ignoramus can't be an Epicurus. You have to know Torah. That's why I spend all day learning. If I'm going to deny it, I have to know exactly what it is. And you have to be learned to be an Epicurus. No shallow Epicurism in his eyes, right? So you have to be learned for that. So just like you can't be as good as holy right now, you also can't be as bad with it because you can't deny as much, right? So because there's not the knowledge, the connection, the ability to deny on the same level because there's not the depth that you can get to for the positive side either.
Well, also we can't be as holy because we can't do all the mitzvot of the temple.
Right.
We can't do 613.
No, we can't. That's not available to us as a group.
There's only three.
Right. Right, three something. Yeah, that we can do today without that. Right. That's correct. So there's that. We don't have all those spiritual pathways that can help us achieve holiness. And then we live in a world without all those spiritual pathways functioning. So we don't have that flow of energy coming into the world. So it's just not available to us. That being said, each generation's job is to accomplish something different. And so our generation's job is to try to accomplish holiness through the specific distractions that we have. Nobody else has been challenged like we've been challenged. So we, thank God, are not being challenged by pogroms or expulsions or poverty or rampant illness, plagues, things like that. That's not our challenge. We don't have to maintain our Judaism in the face of that. Other generations met those challenges. Our generation has to meet the challenge of a connection with God through wealth, through politics, through distraction, through electronics. So nobody's faced this challenge before. It's our specific one. So, and each generation.
With Israel.
And with Israel.
With there being a...
Right, with there being a state of Israel.
State of Israel. That's
right, and now we all have to justify why we still live here in the exile. You know, this is the first generation that's lived in exile by choice. You know, all of us could go if we wanted to. We just choose not to, for whatever reason. You know, we all have our reasons, but it is our choice. We have to see that. And we have to know we'll be taken to task for that. You know, why do we choose it? We have kids, we have money, we have Parnassa issues, we have whatever it is, not comfortable, we don't speak the language, we've been here for a long time, blah, 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 blah. But the truth is,
we're
all making a choice to not live there.
How is it the first generation since Israel
is only 60 years old? It hasn't always been total choice. So the first generation meaning big generation, not the first 20-year generation, but... This is the first time in history. Well, so this actually
we're probably second.
Because after the rebuilding of the second temple, many did not come back from Babylon. They also chose to live in exile. So
most, wasn't it
a lot chose to stay there, right? So, but from the destruction of the second temple until today, everybody is in exile, not by choice.
Is Israel big enough for all? Of
yeah. It is.
But it says in the writings, God is going to gather us from the four corners of the earth.
Right, so now you're talking about a theological controversy. Are we waiting for God to gather us, or did God gather us already?
All in Israel. He hasn't gathered us. If he wanted to gather us, he could have.
Well, so has he or hasn't he?
Necessarily.
That's a theological controversy.
Yeah,
has he or hasn't he? I mean, there's a worldwide network of airlines now with pretty in-reach airfares. You know, I mean, you have to be pretty poor to not be able to function at all in a way that you couldn't somehow borrow, scrape, save enough money to get a plane ticket to Israel. And now there's Nefesh B'Nefesh.
I was going
to
say, the plane ticket's the least of it. You're not just talking
about a plane ticket. No, you're not.
You're
talking about living there and making a living.
Right.
And leaving kids behind or
right. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's easy, and I clearly am here across the table from you. But what I am saying is we do have to look ourselves in the mirror and say, I'm making
this
a choice.
Choice.
I'm making a choice to stay here.
And probably for the first 30 years, there was a need for those in the diaspora to support those in Israel.
Yeah, I think there definitely was. There was not enough money. Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
today it's different.
30 or 40 years, there was a need for us to...
Absolutely, and politically. And now the question is what? So do we still need to be here politically? Well, there certainly is. I think there is a reality of it, and there's also a very strong Yetzirah of it, where a lot of people can justify their staying here by saying, I have to be here for AIPAC. You know, without AIPAC, the state of Israel wouldn't be able to exist.
Or,
you know, or whatever it is. Right, right. So, so what can I tell you? Most people could figure
some
out a way to live there. It's not easy.
Some people have the means, the freedom that they can go.
Some have the means to make it.
Choice.
Some people have the means to make it easy for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about all the Jews who went there with
nothing.
Only the shirt
nothing,
on their back.
Nothing.
Some without shoes on their feet, right? They're living. They're not living like us. You know, I had a friend who's Persian when I was in the army, Tova alone. We're still good friends today. And so I went to sleep at her apartment. I think her parents have 6 or 7 kids. It's a 2-bedroom apartment. So the boys had 1 bedroom, the parents had a bedroom, and the girls slept on the Persian rug in the living room. So I went there for Shabbos. We slept on the floor, right? And her father, her mother was a cafeteria lady scooping out stuff in the cafeteria, and her father sold safety pins and sunglasses on Rehov Yafo. He had a little stand that was like anchored into the concrete with a padlock on it. In the morning, he'd come unlock the padlock, open up, and that was his shop. There was no roof. There was no inside. There was no bathroom. There was no chair. There was no nothing. Winter, spring, summer, fall, he stood outside with selling safety pins and sunglasses and lighters or whatever, like little things. And that's what they lived off of, right? So people can live that way, and they did.
There are a lot of people that get spit out of the land of Israel.
Yes, there are. But a lot of people make those choices, right? And so here's this Persian family. That's how they lived. So there are those who can't make it, and there are those who can't make it because of their mentality. I went to another family's house, a girl that was I was friends with it in the Hebrew U dorm, and her family was from Australia. They lived in Netanya. I opened the door to that apartment. They had shag carpets wall to wall. They had regular American refrigerators at a time when nobody had that stuff, right, and regular beds. They could not make it. They went back to Australia because they weren't living in Israel. They're living in Australia in Netanya, and they couldn't do it. So they all went back for 15, 20 years, and now the kids made Aliyah, re-Aliyah. But the parents couldn't make it. So why couldn't they make it? They couldn't make it because they were too comfortable. Now you could be very comfortable in Israel. But at that time, nobody lived like that. Everybody lived on the sachnut beds that were not so wide, and there were little squishy foam, and you know, you had a naked light bulb in the middle of your room. Nobody had a fixture.
So you're saying they felt guilty? What do you mean they couldn't make
it? No, they couldn't live in Israel. They couldn't live that low in the rest of the world. It was too much of a dichotomy. They lived in a lovely apartment, and then the rest of the world was, you know, still spongia with, you know, whatever. If you're not living in Israel, you can't live in Israel. They weren't living in Israel.
They weren't living like Israel.
They had an ideal to live in Israel, but they had shag carpets. Nobody, I mean, like, you do spongia in Israel. So can't make it. I mean, there are some people who can't eat, and so those people can't make it. But a lot of times, you just can't eat what you want. That's a difference.
Well, sure.
So there's a question of what can't make it means. You know, that's like people say, oh, I can't send my kids to yeshiva, I can't afford it. Really? But you could afford green grass. You know, but you could afford a car that works. Like, what's your priority? Lucy Prenzlau told me about when they started the Hillel Academy. They had parlor meetings that were parlor meetings in people's living rooms. And they talked about how tuition comes before gas and electric, it comes before food, it comes before heat. Teaching your children Torah is the most important thing. That's not the way it is today. Nobody feels that way today. Tuition is last. Yeah, because somehow the school's going to make it. But tuition is last. That's not the way Hillel got started. Hillel got started because tuition was first. And people were cold. If they couldn't afford it, they'd be cold. But their kids were in school. So it's a different world. What can't make it means different things. You know. So, and people say, well, Torah's too hard to keep. So many mitzvahs. And I'm thinking, really? It's too hard in today's world? But, again, you can maintain a nice lawn, you can have a nice house, you can drive a nice car. Maybe it's too hard to have a nice car or a nice lawn. maybe if you don't take care of your lawn or if you don't take care of this, that, then you live in a one-bedroom apartment, then you could keep mitzvahs because the rest of your life is much easier. But with all the other complications, yeah, it's hard. So we have to decide what's the extra in our life. All right, that being said, we all have to make our own cheshbon out about Israel. It's a different thing. And I'm not, in gathering of exiles, I'm not even saying that we should be there necessarily right now. That is a principle of theologic debate, and it is also part of that debate is, has God gathered us or not? Clearly, we are gathered from the four corners of the earth. There's over 100 nationalities represented in Israel today, where Jews have come from everywhere across the globe. There is definitely an ingathering of the exiles. That's undeniable. Is it Erev Mashiach and this is the precursor to it? That is the subject of debate. It is. So it's not clear 100%, but it sure seems like it. It really does.
Since we're there, aren't we required to build the base of
Well, so if you will ask a Teret Kohanim, the yeshiva that prepares Kohanim for service in the Beit HaMikdash, I think they might say that there is a requirement. Although they might say that there's not, because the third Beit HaMikdash will be built in a miraculous way. I don't think you can just build it. But maybe there's an obligation to, let's say, clear the area.
Get started. Prepare.
Something.
Clear your head. That's a little difficult.
Well, clearing the area physically means removing, you know, something that would be extremely controversial. So, could be we're waiting for Hashem to do that. You know, I mean, they've done, and it could be that they're setting it up. So God actually prefers to not work in miraculous ways. He prefers to work in what looks like natural ways. So, for instance, all the excavations that are happening underneath the Temple Mount in the Solomon stables, where the Arabs are busy trying to eradicate any breath of Jewish memory there. So they're taking out all the dirt they can with all the artifacts they can and scooping it and shipping it to places without allowing the Antiquities Authority to look at it, sift it, see it in context, nothing, because they want to take away any Jewish anything. Right? But that's also destabilizing the top of the temple. That's what I'm saying. Exactly what I'm saying is...
Maybe they're preparing it and it'll just collapse.
Right, because there are earthquakes in the area. So it's possible that they're creating enough of an emptiness underneath that the right earthquake will just make the whole thing go. Then, of course, the Jews will be blamed.
I was going to say.
I don't even have to say why, just of course they will be.
For having our stuff under there.
Yeah, no, they'll be blamed for...
It
doesn't matter. Somehow they'll figure out a way to make it our fault. We didn't enforce the laws. We didn't tell them it was our fault. We planned the whole thing in the first place. From Second Temple times until the Second Temple, which didn't exist, but from that time until today, we planned that it should be unstable in case anybody should build something else, so it should collapse in case... What?
Right. It would be our fault.
It will be our fault. It will definitely be our fault, but whatever. It doesn't matter.
Okay, moving on.
Okay, so now the question is, why that spot? Okay, so it is a spot of holiness, and the question is now about, intrinsic holiness versus invested holiness. So there's two ways for something to become holy. One is, it is holy by its very nature. God made it holy. The other is, we make it holy by our investment of energy. So, for instance,
that like the pot that's made by a Jewish person doesn't have to be is holy.
Well,
you toivel it.
Yeah. So I interesting about dishes. It's possible you could say it that way. But let's go to this building right here, right? So this building that we're sitting in right here, Eish HaHavos Yisrael, this piece of land wasn't holy before this building was built. But now that this building wasn't holy before the first prayer was said in it, right? So they raised the money, they made the plans, they built the building, they swept the path, people came in, daven shachris, the place is holy. And the place becomes more and more holy the more it's invested with holy activities, Torah classes and learning and tefillot and whatever it is, it becomes more and more holy. Now let's say the congregation in Eretz Hashem outgrows this building and has all the money they need to have the next sized building, right? But they need a building bigger than this one, on a property bigger than this one, and they can't build it here. So what do they do with this building? Can they sell it to a church? No, they can't, because it's holy. And you can't go down in Kedusha, only up. You could buy a church and make it into a shul, but you can't sell a shul to be made into a church, because you're only allowed to go up in levels of holiness.
Except that the old yeshiva building is a church.
That had to be sold through a few different people. Because first, yeah, they didn't sell it to a church. They sold it to a developer who was going to do something else, who maybe even sold it to somebody else, and that person sold it to a church. But the yeshiva could not have sold it to a church, would not have been permitted. So, because they even thought of that here. It was actually a problem with Aish, because they bought an old church, right? They made it into a shul, and then one of the churches
down the street said, our congregation is shrinking. Your congregation is growing. How about if we trade properties?
So they thought about that. Could we just trade properties? You have a big building, you need a small one. We have a small building, we need a big one. But they couldn't, because that would be taking their shul and making it into a church. So they weren't allowed to do it.
But you can do it through a few steps.
You can't do it. It might happen.
Yeah, okay.
But they didn't do that on purpose. It's not like Confluence Ministries came to Yeshiva and said, we want to buy your building. It's that Yeshiva was moving, and so they sold their building to a developer. The developer then can do what he wants with it. So he was, I don't know if they were going to build apartments in that, got rehab. But then there's nothing in the no reason in the neighborhood to do that, because it just doesn't pay. So it sat for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know if he sold it to somebody else. I think it maybe did pass hands once again. And then Confluence Ministries came and said, what we need in this neighborhood is an urban ministry. Here's an empty building that would be just great. Let's look into buying that. And then they approached the owner. But it wasn't like they tried to do that at all. It happened. Just like Church in the City with BMH.
That's what I was thinking about.
Was that BMH? BMH, right. So it's not like BMH sold to a church.
Yeah,
no. First it was like a yoga studio, and then it was
Community center.
Yeah, Irish community center, and then a Buddhist step lodge or whatever it was. Like, it was a bunch of different things. And then, and then they sold it.
The Ostrava is also now a church.
Pardon?
The Ostrava. Uh-huh. It's on 14th and...
Uh-huh.
Lower.
Right. Yeah, he passed that.
So it can be sold to as another facility, just not something in the religious realm.
Right.
You can't go into something in the religious realm.
Right. So the question is, how does something get holy? So is the Beit HaMikdash built on holy ground, or is it holy because we human beings invested it with holiness? So the answer here is that it's both, is that it's intrinsically holy, because that spot is the belly button of the world. So it's intrinsically holy as the place through which Kedusha enters the world, that Hashem sends that Kedusha into this world, that the world needs an infusion of it, just like we had our souls blown into us, right? So we are where our breath enters and exits, and particularly our mouth. That's why we have so many laws concerning speech, right? And the world is created through speech, and we are co-creators, and we can use speech. So just like that orifice is so important, food that goes in and words that come out have to be appropriate, because that is the place that connects the spiritual and the physical in us. So we have to be extremely careful about what passes through that spot, but it is through that spot that we got our soul. So it's through that spot that the world, in essence, got its soul. Right? The world is here for a reason. It has a spiritual essence. So there is a concept of a soul of the world as well. So the spirituality of the world flows into that spot. That being said, it's made more holy by the investment of human beings in that area. And so the area is less holy right now than it was 2,000 years ago when it was a functioning temple. So even though we go there, and right now all we're going to is the Western Wall, which, as you all know, I'm sure, is just a retaining wall, right? It was a small hill. The first temple was kind of smallish. The second temple actually also was smallish as well, until Herod decided he wanted to make it grand. And in order to make it grand, he needed a bigger hill. So he built walls around the hill and backfilled it to create a bigger platform on which to build a magnificent temple. That was the second temple. And that's the picture that we have here. So this is Solomon's insides, which hopefully we'll look at more as the weeks go on, and hopefully I'll get a better picture. But it's right now all we're doing is going to the wall that held up the backfill. But the reason why the kotel is so holy is because people have davened there for so long.
Right.
It's invested. So that's invested kedusha, not intrinsic kedusha. So the spot where the temple was is intrinsic kedusha, made even more holy with invested kedusha. So
and when the temple was no longer there, it retained.
It retained
its
what
intrinsic
it had.
Holiness.
Yes.
But the invested holiness.
I think it must dissipate
away.
Or something. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's
what
not active in active use.
The Akedah took place there, and the Jacob's dream, and so it was holy.
Right. It's intrinsically holy,
yeah, it's intrinsically
which is why
holy.
It drew those. Right, it drew those things to it. Well, Hashem said to bring the Akedah there. Right, Hashem said to bring Yitzchak there for the sacrifice of Isaac.
Plans for that place.
Pardon?
That's where the Dome of the Rock is.
Right, that's where the Dome of the Rock is. Right, that's the rock. Is the rock upon which Isaac was sacrificed, or according to the Muslims, Ishmael was sacrificed. Pardon?
And then
they also believe that, yeah, that Muhammad
ascended.
Yeah, ascended up from that rock. But yeah, that's also where Jacob had his dream. And possibly, who knows, and does it really matter if it's actually true or not, is that rock the rock? Let's see, it can't be the rock because it was before. The Akedah was before Jacob had his dream. But Jacob's dream had 12 rocks in the beginning and they all became one. So where is that rock? Yeah. Anyway, okay, so there's the intrinsic and the invested kedusha of the place. That being said now, so how do we tap into that kedusha? How will we balance out? So we know, looking at this last paragraph on 361, that we are physical beings, and when we do a sin, we do that sin not just with our thought, not just with our heart, but with our bodies. We speak Lashon Hara. We steal something with our hand. We, whatever it is, so we thought about it, we internalized it, and we did it. So doing tshuva, it's not enough to just think, I'm sorry, gosh, I shouldn't have done that. Or to even say, I'm sorry, gosh, I shouldn't have done that. We have to involve our bodies in the tshuva process. So what we engaged in the process of creating negativity has to be engaged in the process of rectification. So for that reason, it's important to have a physical process that one can go through. And that is one reason for the korbanot, that there should be some kind of physical process that one can engage in that will engage every aspect of their being that was engaged in the sin, in the reparation of that sin. So it has nothing to do really with, it does have to do with, which we'll see, but it doesn't really have to do with sacrificing, although there isn't a concept in that too. So there's a few different concepts in korbanot, which hopefully we'll go into more deeply, but one is, for reparation korbanot, for tshuva korbanot, to engage your whole body in it. And then you have korbanot that are Thanksgiving korbanot, or just elevation korbanot, right? So then how does that work? He discusses that. We'll look at that in a minute. And then the third kind of korban is just a daily Thanksgiving korban, a regular process. And that's also is part of the process of keeping the world's body and soul together, which I have to try to understand more deeply. But just like food keeps our body and soul together, when we eat, our soul stays in our body. And if we don't eat, our soul will leave our body after a certain amount of time. The food keeps it knitted together. So too, korbanot have an aspect of a korban is that it helps keep the soul and the spiritual aspect and the physical aspect of the world knitted together. How does that work in these days when we don't have korbanot? We at least have tefillot.
So there are three types. There's that type.
There's that type of the knitting together,
right.
That process. There's the expiation type, the, you know, tshuva type.
Right.
And then there's the elevation, Thanksgiving
okay.
type, right? Three general types.
Right.
There's probably more than that, but those
and
are conceptual
tshuva,
types.
The elevation and the...
And the knitting kind.
Yeah, so those,
body
right.
and soul together.
So those are the three functions
right.
of korbanot. I'm not saying those are the three types of korbanot. Those
okay.
are three functions of korbanot. Those three different functions. And we'll talk about different types of korbanot. But conceptually, those are three functions of korbanot. Right. So the Rambam says, because, and this is on page 363, because human deeds are carried to completion by thought, speech, and action, the Eternal Lord, blessed be He, ordained that when a person sins, he is to bring an offering and rest his hands upon it, which constitutes action. He is to confess his sin with his mouth, which constitutes speech, and he is to burn in the altar fire, in the altar fire, the entrails and the kidneys, which are the vessels of thought and desire. So it's not actually his thought and desire, it's the vessels in the animal of thought and desire, and the legs, which corresponds to a man's hand and feet that do all his work. The blood is to be sprinkled on the altar, corresponding to his blood, which gives him life, so that a man will consider, as he does all these acts, that he sinned towards God with his body and his spirit, and he deserves that his blood should be spilled and his body should be burned, if not for the kindness of the Creator, that he has taken from him the offering as an exchange and a ransom, that its blood should instead, it should be instead of his blood, one life in lieu of another. Let's just stop there for a second. So there is one life in lieu of another, and yet it's not. That is the way that it's said. But it's important to understand, and we'll see it, I think, just as we go on a little bit further. How could it be one life in lieu of another? Is an animal really worth a human life? And can you really give an animal instead of a human life? And is that what we're doing? We're just transferring our sins onto an animal, and the animal is offered instead of us? Could it be that pagan? Really? That's very, very crude as a system. So I don't think it can be that. But it, I think we can see it more deeply as we were created to be in charge of this world, both to shepherd it and to use it for our needs. So, for instance, we're allowed to eat meat, one life, for the sake of another. We're permitted to kill an animal to consume it so that we can live through their death. And plants, too. We live through their death. We kill them and eat them. We kill the animal, we eat the animal. That life goes into our life, right? We're permitted to do that. And I think that's what is happening here, too, is that it's a use of life, not an exchange necessarily. It's not an exchange. It's the using of that life to cause in us the feelings to understand the severity of what we did. That in witnessing death, one does, even the death of an animal, it does bring, it causes one to pause and consider as they see the life flow from something and they see the blood and they know they have it too. And animals do. I mean, that's why we can relate to them. They do, in a way, look similar to us. They have faces with expression, you know, and they can move in ways that are similar to us. So it does make us feel like, oh my gosh, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go I. And but what's the difference between me and him? Me and that animal and me. So that's what it's saying here, is that you have to see. Let's see if I should read more of this part.
Yes, that sentence. Moreover, the daily offering is sacrifice because people generally cannot avoid sinning continually.
Right.
We have to pray every day.
Right. Every day. So it's fascinating to see. Let's see. It's fascinating to see why we give these offerings and that it does bring us to a place of repentance and that there is this concept of repentance in all these ways, but then there's more. So now is the concept of sacrifice. This paragraph is about actual sacrifice, that word, not sacrifices in the idiomatic sense, but actual sacrifice. So the Rambam continues, on the level of truth, though, there is a hidden mystic meaning, as is written in his commentary in Siddur Vayikra. We can continue by way of plain explanation to say that for this root reason, God commanded us always to bring offerings of those things for which the heart longs, such as meat, wine, and bread, so that the heart should be more aroused as one has recourse to them, and the poor man is obligated to bring a bit of his flour, over which his eyes and heart are concerned the entire day. So that is the concept of sacrifice. Something that you want, you now don't get because of what you did. Or what you need to do, right? So you do have to give up something of value to you according to what's valuable to you. And this is according to your financial level. If you have a lot, you should be giving, you know, an ox. And if you have a little, you should be giving a measure of flour. But, or somewhere in between. Right? It might be a goat instead of an ox or whatever it is.
What's interesting is that we draw the parallel between sacrifice, or korbanot, and tefillah.
Yes.
More than we draw it between sacrifice and tzedakah.
Well, it isn't Sadaka.
Correct. Correct. It's not all Sadaka.
It's not Sadaka.
I mean, this one.
This is saying sacrifice. So we talk about, the tefillah today replaces korbanot. Because if you understand korbanot, it's not, only this part is about sacrifice.
Right.
In general, a korban is not about sacrificing. It's about the process of what it is, which is what tefillah is.
Process.
So it's the process. It's the process of engaging one's heart, mind, body, and soul. So not so easy to engage body in tefillah. That's one reason for shuckling, and one reason for crying, is you're supposed to engage your body in tefillah. It shouldn't just. And one reason for actually mouthing it. You're not supposed to just have the prayer in your heart. You're supposed to express it. And if you can cry, you're supposed to cry. And if you can move a little bit through it, it helps engage your body in the process. So so that tefillah can be more of a heart, mind, body, soul, all of those things together, which is what korbanot were. Korbanot.
Are you allowed to shuffle during Shemoneh Esrei?
Yeah, you can or not.
Because you read about these great gedolim that stood perfectly still.
Some shuckle, some don't shuckle. It depends on what brings you to the greatest kavana.
This way.
Yeah, it totally depends on what brings you to kavana. Another place, though, of korban is, who could tell me? You all know. Something else. Something else.
An offering.
That's an offering that we do that's about process. Kapparas are even closer to meals. When we share a meal with somebody, for sure a Shabbos or Yontif meal or any mitzvah meal, which is why we dip our bread in salt, because our table is an altar. Our table is like the Mizbeach. We put salt on the Mizbeach. We salted the offerings. We salt our bread because our meal is an offering. What kind of offering? It's a korban. Really, so it's not an offering, it's a korban, it's a close maker. When you share food with somebody, you're becoming closer to them, and you should use the opportunity to become closer to God as well, which is why you're supposed to share words of Torah when you share food with somebody. And it's considered, we learned in Pirkei Avos, somebody who does not share words of Torah when they share food with somebody is like eating sacrifices to the dead. That's what it says in Pirkei Avos, remember that? It's not even like they didn't make a proper offering. It's like eating, it's like their food is eating sacrifices to the dead. Meaning what they're doing is the opposite of what they're supposed to be doing. Sharing that meal should give them life. It gives them physical sustenance, it gives them life, but it should also give them spiritual sustenance that gives them life. And so we are supposed to, and that's what our Shabbos meals are supposed to be about, how do we sustain ourselves spiritually? So we have the food sustenance, just like on a fast day, we don't have food so that we will feel a loss because we're all too spiritually dense at this point to feel a loss for the temple. How can we feel that? You know, we didn't even know what it was like. How could we miss it? We don't miss it. So what we do is we don't eat so that we're missing something, so that we feel like I'm missing something. Let me try to channel this feeling towards the temple. I'm empty. I'm lost. I'm yearning for something. It could be the temple that I'm yearning for, right? So we use food for that. The same thing on Shabbos. We use food for it's lovely, it's yummy, it's pleasant, it's connecting, it's a fun time with family and friends, and it should be connecting with us and God. It's yummy, it's pleasant, it's connecting, right? And we use food to start us off that way. So we shouldn't just have it as yummy. It should be spiritually yummy too, and that's why we try to share words of Torah, even if it's just a little word of Torah, but something to connect us. A thought about the parsha, a question that we have, whatever it is, something to help connect us to that. So then there's not the sacrifice in that. Although, if you've made Shabbos, you know how much it costs, then maybe it is a sacrifice in that.
So it is better to have guests at your table for Shabbos.
It is better to connect at your table. So it depends on who you need to connect with. And what brings you to that connection. So I'll just give you, for instance, in our early years of marriage with little children, it was very important to have a lot of guests at our Seder table for us because It wasn't lively enough for us without, we didn't have multiple generations. We didn't have aunts and uncles and cousins. We were too frum to really be included in the family Seder. We didn't necessarily want that, and they certainly didn't want us in our frumkeit at that Seder. So how do we make our Seder the way we wanted it to be? It wouldn't work with just a fry me and a 2-year-old and a baby, you know, or a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old and 2 babies. Like, that's not really a Seder, right? And so invite for us. Then, and then we learned lots of songs and we learned more Divrei Torah. And then as we grew as a couple, it was important for us to invite guests for them. We became an important place of sharing Torah with others. Now we have grown children with children, starting with children, and it's, we'll include fewer guests in it, even though it is an important place. And we make sure especially to include new Balei Teshuva and especially new Gerim. Because new converts don't really know what a Seder looks like. They must be invited for the first several years to learn the songs, to learn the patterns, to see what it looks like. We learned what it's like from the guests that we invited early on. We shared in the middle. Now we have a whole family that needs us. And we need to be giving to our children and our grandchildren at the Seder. It's a different type of a Seder now. We now are capable of giving to them in a serious way and having a multi-generational Seder like we dreamed of, but now we're the in charge of it. So now we can include a few, but we don't want to have a ton of guests because then that takes away from our goal of giving to our children, which we weren't capable of really earlier on. So it depends on where you're holding and how you choose to fill your table and how you choose to create those connections. Okay, I guess to be continued next week.
Yes.
It's a good thing that you snapped your clothes because I didn't even look at the clock. So
it's interesting.
We'll continue.
Keep going.
Yeah.